Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. But we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. Ukraine's President Zelensky has been pleading with his allies for months to allow Ukraine to fire Western-supplied long-range missiles deep into Russia. It certainly has the means to do so with TACAMs supplied by the United States and Storm Shadows supplied by the United Kingdom. And he again made the case for restrictions on their use being lifted in a speech today in Kyiv.
The Russians are using their aviation to launch 4,000 guided bombs a month in the east. What is the use of TACAMs in the form that we have them today? If you cannot use them on their military bases or on their sites where they have helicopters or on their military airfields where they have their airplanes, there's no point.
President Putin, though, has warned of consequences if restrictions on the use of these long-range missiles are lifted by the United States and the UK. And his warning was repeated today by Russia's UN ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, at a meeting of the UN Security Council in New York.
If the decision to lift restrictions is really taken, that will mean that from that moment, NATO countries are conducting direct war with Russia. In that case, we will have to, as you understand, take the relevant decisions with all the consequences for this that the Western aggressors would incur.
Well, the two men who could make the decision to allow Ukraine to fire long-range missiles into Russia are meeting today in Washington. President Biden and the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer. I spoke earlier to Daniel Freed, a former US Assistant Secretary of State for Europe, who served as US Ambassador to Poland when it joined NATO in 1988. He's now a Distinguished Fellow at the Atlantic Council. He explained why he's in favour of allowing Ukraine to freely use the weapons.
There should be no restrictions on Ukraine's use of weapons to defend itself other than the restrictions of the laws of war. It's not that there is nothing to discuss with Ukraine about what makes sense for the use of these weapons. They're not available in unlimited supplies. There are questions of what targets are the best kind of targets. But to have a public discussion of red lines and limitations serves no interest that I can see other than Vladimir Putin's interest in getting us to debate with ourselves. It's not that I favor any use of any weapon for any purpose. It's that this should not be discussed publicly. And I'm afraid we've put ourselves in a difficult position where whatever we do is second-guessed.
So you believe that the United States should never have supplied TACAMs to Ukraine in the first place and placed restrictions on their use?
I think that there should be no hard and fast restrictions on Ukrainian use of weapons other than the laws of war. But there should also be an understanding that the U.S. and Ukraine will privately discuss the best use of those weapons. Ultimately, it's Ukraine's call, but Ukraine ought to consult with the U.S. But these consultations need to take place privately instead of these public discussions where the Russians get to threaten war and we have to agonize in public about the risks of escalation, which is, I think, a tactical mistake.
So you don't accept as in any way serious President Putin's warning that Russia would be at war with the United States and allies if they lifted restrictions?
I'm old enough to remember Nikita Khrushchev's bluster. The Russians, like the Soviets, will say anything if they think it will achieve even a marginal tactical purpose. They're very good at pounding the table with their shoe or their fist or otherwise. There is not zero risk, but let's be clear and blunt about it. Russia has nuclear weapons. Well, so do we. So we should not put ourselves in the position of shaking whenever the Russians pound the table.
And it doesn't worry you in any way that were the United States and possibly the United Kingdom lift restrictions on the use of their long-range missiles in Ukraine, that it's a decision that would not necessarily be acceptable to all NATO allies. And I'm thinking here particularly of Germany.
I think that we need to keep clear in our minds what we're discussing, which is a war of aggression and national extermination launched by Russia against Ukraine. Now, it is possible that the Russians will increase their retaliation. This could get worse. And for me to say that there is zero risk is foolhardy and irresponsible. But the risk of the Ukrainian defeat and the risk of the damage to all of our interests if Russia wins this war is very high. And we ought to make calculations on this basis.
That was Daniel Freed, a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Europe. And I've also been speaking to the BBC's Tom Bateman in Washington and put it to him that perhaps there were still reservations in the Biden administration about lifting the restrictions.
There are, and most importantly, they are held by the only person who makes the decision on this, and that's the President of the United States. You know, whenever you go to officials in the US government and try to get some clarity about decisions on this, there is always a sort of sense of frustration being able to try and get closer to an answer about what the decision might be, because literally a decision on something like this is made by Joe Biden. And I don't think we're at the point where he's made up his mind yet. Obviously, what we've had is a growing sense of pressure from the Ukrainians. President Zelensky has been making this argument for months that they want the capability to fire long-range weapons into Russia to get those attacks at source. But so far, Joe Biden has been cautious about this. I think he's very concerned, and he's mentioned it in the past, you know, about weapons hitting Moscow, for example, which would clearly be seen as an escalation. The Europeans are in a bit of a different place now, and I think that's why we're seeing the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer in Washington now. I think they're much more convinced by what Mr. Zelensky is saying. It seems they're signalling they would like the capability to give authority to the Ukrainians to use European-supplied long-range weapons. They don't want to do that without American approval. Whether or not the Americans will permit that or at least give their blessing to it. And then it's another question about whether the Americans would allow their own missiles to be used in such a way by the Ukrainians. We're not at that place yet. And what the White House has made clear today is that it, for one, is not going to make an announcement today, that so far its policy on this issue hasn't changed.
Why this reluctance on the part of President Biden?
What we've seen throughout the war in Ukraine is apparent red lines set by President Putin, and they've come in a lot of different forms. But, for example, if you look at the issue of the supply of F-16 jets, which the Ukrainians have been asking for a long time, President Putin had laid down sort of similar threats and warnings about if that happened. In the end, the West supplied them without a game-changing consequence from the Russians. So I think there's a sense among some Western allies, and particularly the Europeans, that what President Putin is doing again is simply saber-rattling. Now, I do think that argument carries in Washington, that it has some traction. President Biden was asked very briefly by a reporter a bit earlier this week, you know, what's going on? Is there going to be a change in the decision or a decision about the use of long-range weapons? And he said, we're working on it. So clearly it's under consideration. But in the end, it does come back to that point that, you know, only one person makes the decision. I think that it's an important signal that the Americans have been very vocal about how they believe Iran supplying short-range ballistic missiles to Russia, which they've talked about this week, changes the calculation somewhat. That may be laying the groundwork for them to say, well, look, the Russians are now using this capability supplied by the Iranians. That changes the dynamic. And what they've said in the past is as the Russians have changed the battlefield, have evolved their tactics, then the West has been prepared to go further as well. So they may be laying the groundwork for this, but I just don't think we're quite in the place yet where the US president has actually made his mind up.
The BBC's Tom Bateman in Washington. Now, what's it like being stranded in space? Well, two NASA astronauts stuck for the moment at the International Space Station have said they don't feel let down by Boeing despite being stranded there because of problems with the company's spacecraft. Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore were supposed to be on an 8-day mission but will be at the space station for 8 months and should return in February next year. Sonny Williams said they would use their time productively.
We're here with our friends. I think that's really a key part of being on the International Space Station and actually just doing the work. So that's, I think the up part is we're here with our friends. We've got a ride home and we're looking forward to the next couple months and doing a lot of stuff for the International Space Station.
Well, let's speak to Katie Coleman, a former NASA astronaut and retired as a colonel in the United States Air Force. She spent almost 6 months living and working aboard the International Space Station and is now on the line. And Katie, how important is it when you set off on a mission to the ISS to know how long you're going to be there?
Well, in some ways, I don't think it's important. It's nice to have initial expectations. In that press conference, Butch talked a lot about resilience. It's so many of the values that at NASA we have. I mean, I'm retired from there now, but there's certainly ones to live by. Is just, you know, in a way, I think we're going to redefine the word stranded in this case, in that I tried to tell people, you know, you can't use this word stranded because, you know, they do have a ride home and they are, you know, they're accomplishing so much. And so is the crew that's already up there. And I think that sort of redefining stranded means you couldn't do what you were going to do, right. But now what can you do while you're there? And that's what they're showing us, I think, especially involving the rest of the family.
But it's the thought that they were up there or should have been up there for eight days.
8 days.
Yep. And 8 days has become 8 months. I mean, for goodness sake, that's quite a change, isn't it?
It certainly is. I would actually say, I mean, I do know them both well, and you know, for Sunny, I think it's said that this is her happy place is to be up in space. It's quite a change. And at the same time, you know, by being the shepherds of the Boeing capsule, their fate was to then have a very short mission and to then get to do the work that they really live for and that they're already really good at. It's hard for me to, I'm somebody who spent almost 6 months up there and would have in a minute spent another 6 months. And it's because of what you're doing. And there's really, I mean, I hate to say it, but there's not, except for the fact that it is hard on your family as well. It's an amazing place where you just have so many different perspectives. And as Sunny said, she's really eager to share them with the ground and she's glad to have a little more time to do that along with her other crewmates up there, Don Pettit, Jeanette Apps, Mike Barrett, okay, Tracy Caldwell.
Katie, look, many thanks for that. It's fun being on the ISS. Clearly, from what you're saying, that was Katie Coleman, a former NASA astronaut and retired colonel in the US Air Force, author of a new book, Sharing Space. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, the BBC's Joe Robinson has been to the annual Ig Nobel Awards ceremony, which gives prizes for unusual scientific research.
Many mammals are capable of breathing through their anus.
This requires receiving an enema of an oxygenated liquid. While no doubt unpleasant, researchers believe it could have major applications.
More on that in about 5 minutes. But first, our headlines this hour. President Biden is meeting Britain's Prime Minister about now to discuss whether to let Ukraine fire Western-supplied long-range weapons at Russia. And a military court in the Democratic Republic of Congo has sentenced 37 people to death for taking part in an alleged coup attempt. You're listening to NewsHour, coming to you live from London. Geoengineering is a broad term for a range of technologies that aim to combat climate change by manipulating Earth's climate systems on a large scale. And a British science agency has just announced that it will provide around $75 million for researchers to examine ideas for artificially cooling the planet, including outdoor experiments, to see whether any of these ideas actually work. The announcement by the Advanced Research and Invention Agency, or ARIA, is among the largest single infusions of money to date into solar geoengineering, which was explained to me by Sir David King, who is a former British chief scientific officer.
So solar geoengineering is a term that is used for the business of trying to reflect sunlight away from either areas of the planet or from the whole planet. Solar geoengineering is a phrase used to describe how we would cool the planet down, given that it's heating up very rapidly at the moment, or where we could choose particular areas of the planet, and my favorite would be the North Pole region, and cool that region down during the polar summer months so that we can keep the ice that is formed over that region present during those summer months.
So do I take it that you and other like-minded scientists have given up on limiting the effects of climate change rather than trying to limit the causes, which is carbon dioxide emissions?
That's exactly not what I'm doing. So you will know that I've been involved in this in the British government since 2000. As chief scientific advisor, this was my main preoccupation. And initially, I was totally focused on only one project, and that was reducing emissions. Stop using fossil fuels. Stop using oil, gas, and coal. We are now emitting more than ever before. 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide, add methane, and we're up above 50 billion tons a year going into the atmosphere. And this is simply asking for a disaster. We have not managed to get a global agreement to reduce emissions year on year going forward in time. It should begin happening, and I'm still, of course, working on that. But since it's not happening now, and we can see the impacts of climate change already happening today, loss and damage is probably in the region of $500 billion a year at the moment from climate change events around the world. And if we don't manage to cool certain areas of the world, quite simply, we're going to run out of time to manage this by reducing emissions. And we will also need to capture excess greenhouse gases in the atmosphere at a large scale. We're going to need to capture 20 billion tons of greenhouse gases a year, and then we'd have to keep doing that to the end of the century to create a manageable future for humanity. That's the seriousness of the situation. It is not possible to manage this only by reducing emissions, but that is an essential feature. But we also need to do these other things in order to manage to have a future for humanity.
Is there any risk involved, do you think, by doing it unilaterally, which is what the UK is trying to do at the moment?
No risk at all in doing the experiments. In fact, doing the experiments is vital. We do not want to see countries that are seriously at risk from the impacts of climate change, and there are many places in the world in this situation, simply trying to do this at scale without the proper conduction process of the experiments to check that there are no negative impacts from doing this. But the questions can, again, only be answered by doing experiments before anyone runs this at scale.
That was Sir David King, former British chief scientific advisor. And a different kind of science now. Proof that pigs can breathe out of their backsides. A military project to create pigeon-guided missiles and a Europe-wide study that flipped over 350,000 coins to work out the odds have all been recognised at the annual Ig Nobel Awards. The awards are a tongue-in-cheek answer to the Nobel Prizes in Sweden and celebrate seemingly absurd but potentially groundbreaking research. Joe Robinson reports from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
The day breaks, then your phone breaks, then your car's brakes start to fail.
The principle that if something can go wrong, it will go wrong, or Murphy's Law, was born from the field of aerospace engineering. The audience at this year's annual Ig Nobel Awards were treated to not just one, but four musical tributes to the concept.
It is again time to perform the rotation of the laureates.
The proudly nerdy organisers invited five Nobel laureates to stand in front of the theatre and spin on the spot, and to hand out 10 prizes to teams from around the world who have made amongst the silliest sounding contributions to science.
The two pigeons are at either end of a small ping pong table.
First, the Ig Nobel Peace Prize was handed out to B.F. Skinner, the pioneering, if controversial, behavioural psychologist. Famed for his work reinforcing behaviour in pigeons, a lesser-known application was his World War II-era initiative to train pigeons to be used to navigate guided missiles.
I want to thank you for finally acknowledging his most important contribution.
Awarded posthumously, his daughter Julie Vargas accepted the award on his behalf.
The ones that were involved with Project Pigeon were in our backyard when I was a little girl. I used to play with them. I have a picture of me holding one of them, actually. You know, it was top secret for so many years. Oh, it was a long time after it was ended that it was actually okay to talk about it. I don't know why they had radar by then.
In the field of probability, Dutch researchers took the gong for their study, which proved the odds of a coin flip landing on the same side it started were slightly more than 50-50. They learnt this by enlisting volunteers across Europe to flip over 350,000 coins. František Bartoš led the study.
I'm very excited and very happy. I think it kind of highlights the field of statistics that's often forgotten in the field of science.
How did you find volunteers for this?
Basically, I tried to persuade my friends and my colleagues at the university to spend a day with me before the Christmas and to just spend a whole day flipping coins.
We must succeed in making people fail.
One of the highlights of the awards were the winners in the field of physiology. The team from Tokyo Medical and Dental School successfully proved, well,
many mammals are capable of breathing through their anus.
This requires receiving an enema of an oxygenated liquid. While no doubt unpleasant, researchers believe it could have major applications. The team are now beginning phase one trials on humans and hope the technique could provide an alternative to mechanical ventilation.
COVID-19 put so much, you know, endangered patients with the respiratory failure condition, so maybe we can provide alternative means to help patients with lung problems.
To cap off the evening, the traditional closing remarks were left to MIT bookstore staff member Barry Duncan.
Goodbye.
Then you get struck by a dump truck. Is it just luck? Just some quirk.
Barry Duncan playing the piano at the end of that report by Joe Robinson at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us, a lot more to come in the next 30 minutes.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution,
this is the most amazing time ever, and developments in AI are super, super quickly changing,
to the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
You're with NewsHour, and police in the Italian city of Turin today said they'd seized millions of pirated retro video games consoles from the late 1980s and 90s worth $52 million and dismantled an operation trafficking them from China. The police said games from this period are enjoying a boom as part of the so-called retro gaming trend. So what's behind this resurgence in popularity of games from decades past? I've been speaking to Jay McDonald, founder of the website Retro Game Start and himself a retro game enthusiast.
I grew up on the classic console starting in the 70s. And then it was in 2018, I started getting interested again and wanted to share the experience with my daughter, who's a teenager. And what I found was she genuinely enjoyed them, having no nostalgia for them, but just having fun.
But the technology is a little primitive, isn't it, compared to modern video game consoles?
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. And that limitation is a plus because it forced game makers to be more creative in certain ways. And also, the advancement of technology is kind of a poor yardstick for measuring the successful design of a game, whether it's actually enjoyable or not, whether it's engaging and serves a good purpose. We've kind of been lulled into this idea that everything needs to advance, become faster, more high resolution, and that benefits certain types of gameplay, but there are other things that it just doesn't really do much for.
These retro games, they're cheaper, I would imagine, than the modern ones?
Typically, yes. Prices all over the board. There are a lot of people who've gotten in because of speculation and collecting, and so certain prices have gone up, but if you're just going to go out and buy a used vintage cartridge somewhere, yes, definitely.
I mean, are you surprised that there appears to be this vast market for the fake vintage video game consoles?
Well, I'm not surprised in that retro gaming has become a real trend. What I am surprised about is why aren't the copyright holders meeting this market need? As someone who makes a living in the creative space, I believe in copyright law, and I think that IP law should be respected, and I'm not an advocate for piracy. But I do understand that there are people who want access to things, and the companies that are the actual holders of all these properties don't seem to be giving people what they're looking for. A little bit here, a little bit there, but it would be nice if they would just recognize that there's this market and be more robust about how they engage with it.
So you think games companies should make more of these games available, and that would put an end to the fake market?
Well, you're always going to have a price game. The multi-cart that's hundreds of games or whatever it is, that's always going to price undercut something that a legitimate company will sell. But I think it would reduce that level of interest because it's a better experience if you can get a real console, a real cartridge that is legitimately produced and high quality.
That was a retro game enthusiast, Jay McDonald. This is NewsHour. And this is NewsHour coming to you live from the BBC in London. I'm Julian Marshall. And we go now to Borno State in northeast Nigeria, where the state capital, Maiduguri, has been half submerged in flooding caused by heavy rain, made worse by a dam bursting earlier in the week. The state governor, Babagana Zulum, has told the BBC 2 million people have been affected by the flooding, many of them desperately short of food and shelter. In Maiduguri, army trucks have been driving through the streets, pulling people from the floodwaters. And the BBC has been speaking to these survivors in the state capital.
We left my husband behind when we had to cross a bridge. We don't know whether he was able to leave and got to safety, because he is blind. In this camp, they cook food, but we don't get it.
The flood started around dawn. We'd blocked where the water was coming with bags of sand, but the water eventually forced its way. The water started flowing into our house, and it got to my chest. I have 17 kids, and 14 are here with me.
Well, Governor Zaloom said he was worried that the floods were compounding the 15-year insurgency in the state by Boko Haram Islamist militants who were responsible for widespread destruction and death. His words have been voiced by a colleague for clarity.
I can remember more than 300,000 people who were killed in Borno State. Thousands of classrooms were destroyed. Hundreds of health facilities were destroyed by the insurgency. We are just trying to get out of this problem, and now we witness another disaster, a very serious calamity, another serious humanitarian crisis.
The words of the Borno State Governor, Babagana Zaloom. And just before we came on air, I spoke to the BBC's Azizat Oluwalua in Maiduguri.
The condition in Maiduguri generally is that of desperation and frustration. I am at the Maiduguri Public Health Hospital, the largest in Nigeria. It was flooded until yesterday, and residents around this area, when we were coming here, because the area has been cordoned off, so when we were coming here, we saw hundreds of people who came to their homes to pack some things and on their way to the settlement camps, because their homes, although not flooded, but they are in disarray. There are muds everywhere, and it's the same situation in all the wards we went to. The hospital authorities told me that they had to evacuate about 500 patients on the day of the flooding because it was a frantic effort. You know, they had to call more nurses in to assist, and then some people that were around, and they had to take them to the upper tier of the building.
And floodwaters are still around, are they, in the roads?
Yes, so there are still floodwaters still around in other parts of Maiduguri. About 40% of the city is still flooded, according to the state governor. And we went to around four communities yesterday where the governor went to give relief materials, and they are still quite much flooded, up to about 3 feet, you know. Nice. So, search and rescue are still ongoing. The Red Cross still went out today to rescue more people. They went around to check if there were dead bodies floating on the flood water, because we saw two yesterday when we went out. And that's why officials are yet to give a substantive statement on the number of casualties and those that have been displaced.
And those people who have been displaced, who have been forced out of their homes, is there anywhere for them to get shelter and food?
Yes, in fact, that was one of the main steps taken by the state government, you know, when the thing happened. About four settlement centres are in operation at the moment, and I know some schools have been turned to temporary shelters as well, because the government closed the school for 2 weeks on Tuesday when the news broke, because more and more people are going to the settlement centres, unable to salvage any of their belongings. They have nothing on them, so they are unable to provide for their families. But many of them are complaining about hunger. And I put this question through to the governor in my exclusive interview, and he admitted that they cannot provide for everyone, and that's why they need help from every person that could offer help to these people.
So most of the assistance at the moment is coming, what, from the state government, or has the federal government intervened?
Absolutely. The federal government moved swiftly, asking the National Emergency Management Agency to come to the state to support their state affiliation. And when I spoke to the zonal director of the agency, they said they too are going to support the effort of the government by distributing food to displaced persons, because that is the immediate need of every person that's spoken to. Those that are still stuck, you know, trapped at home, are also hungry as well. Yesterday, I saw lots of people on the rooftops of their submerged houses, and they had gone for days without food and clean water. And there is a lot of heightened worry about a possible outbreak of waterborne diseases like cholera, because water sources have been contaminated due to the collapse of the sewers.
I know the governor has already reflected on the impact of the flooding in a state which has borne the brunt of the insurgency by Boko Haram Islamist militants. People must be despairing.
Absolutely. People are despairing. Even the governor is as well, you know, saying that he's worried. And on the same breath as well, he said that he's confident the rehabilitation program, the state government put in place is using positive result, because they have been able to rehabilitate some former Boko Haram insurgents who, you know, downed their tools and declared that they were going to told peaceful lines. But there is this level of uncertainty of what to expect, because the report we got was that about 200 inmates escaped, and some of them were leaders of the Boko Haram insurgent group.
Okay, so as a result of the flooding, you're saying that a number of imprisoned Boko Haram militants, among them leaders of the group, have managed to escape and are now at large?
Absolutely. So that's why the governor is worried. But again, he said that he is sure that the state is going to rise above it.
That was the BBC's Azizat Olalolua in Maiduguri. Now, ever since the Kremlin's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, there have been widespread reports of Russians reporting fellow citizens to the police for anti-war views, often leading to prosecution and, in some cases, prison sentences. It's revived memories of the Soviet past when informing on colleagues and neighbours was actually encouraged. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has been meeting some of those caught up in this new wave of denunciations.
Handcuffed, a doctor is led into a Moscow courtroom and locked in a cage. Her name is Nadezhda Buyanova. She's 68. She's a paediatrician, and she's on trial for spreading false information about the Russian army. She faces up to 10 years in prison. I managed to ask Nadezhda what she makes of this. I've read about this kind of thing happening to others, Nadezhda replies through the glass. I never imagined it would happen to me. It's happening because of this woman, a patient's mother. She claims that the doctor told her Russian soldiers in Ukraine are legitimate targets. She was furious. Her ex-husband had been killed fighting in Ukraine. She denounced Nadezhda to the police. That word, danos, denunciation, you hear it often now in Russia. Oleg Orlov experienced it firsthand. The human rights activist was denounced over an anti-war article he'd written. He was jailed for 2.5 years, but freed early in a prisoner swap. He's no longer in Russia. The machine of repression is working like in Joseph Stalin's time, Oleg tells me in a video call. There's no rationality to it. Now it's repression for the sake of repression. One of Stalin's ministers praises a boy who has denounced his own father as an enemy of the people. Denunciation was actively encouraged under Stalin. The gulag was full of victims who'd been snitched on by fellow citizens. Nina Khrushcheva is professor of international affairs at the New School in New York. She can see that today Russians are having no problem turning the clock back.
What I find really remarkable is how quickly Russian genetic memory has come back. How people who didn't live in those times suddenly act as if they did. Suddenly they are squealing on others. It is a Soviet practice, but it's also something about the Russian genetic code of fear, of trying to protect themselves at the expense of others.
And it is Russia's war in Ukraine which is fueling this. Not only through repressive new laws aimed at silencing dissent, but by turbocharging here the hunt for internal enemies, for traitors. It's in this atmosphere of us against them that you get students informing on teachers, professors on students, parishioners on priests. And 400 miles north of Moscow, neighbour on neighbour. Hairdresser Anna Alexandrova had fallen out with her neighbour, Irina, over a plot of land in their village. Their feud led to Anna being reported to the police for posting anti-war messages. She denies sending them, but she's on trial now for spreading fake news about the army, and she faces up to 15 years in prison.
This
began as an ordinary domestic squabble, Anna's defense lawyer, Anastasia Pilipenko, tells me. But the so-called political articles of the criminal code have become a useful way of resolving problems between neighbors. Some Russians aren't just writing denunciations. They're taking the law into their own hands. On a Moscow bus, 87-year-old Dmitry Grinchy is attacked by two men who claim they've just heard him make insulting comments about Russian mercenaries fighting in Ukraine. Shocking mobile phone video shows the pensioner having his arms twisted behind his back, then being dragged off the bus and frog-marched to the police. He wasn't charged, but the incident has left the pensioner shaken and angry. The Russian constitution says that everyone has the right to free speech, Dmitry tells me. Why should others get to say what they think and not me? In his flat, Dmitry shows me old photos of his father, Pavel, who in 1937 was arrested and then executed, one of the many innocent victims of Stalin's terror. History never repeats itself exactly, but what is happening today is reviving ghosts of the past, with Russia once again searching for enemies and traitors, and Russians being encouraged to join the hunt.
That report by the BBC's Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. This is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Footage emerged this week of Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu being interrogated by Israeli anti-corruption officers. The never-seen-before police footage featured in a documentary called The BB Files, which was screened at the Toronto Film Festival. The recordings were made between 2016 and 2018 as part of a collection of evidence to determine if there should be an indictment against him on charges of bribery, fraud and breach of trust. He was later indicted in 2019 and is awaiting trial. In this clip, Mr. Netanyahu defends accepting gifts, among them cigars and champagne, from friend and Hollywood film producer Arnon Milchan.
He knows I work hard. This is a tough job. And he says, if I can sweeten the life of my brother, who serves the state of Israel, when the public is critical and when he's being pursued by the media and the police, he said, maybe to give him some joy in his life, I'll give him some cigars. So is this a crime? How terrible.
And Mr. Netanyahu's words were, of course, voiced up. Well, last year, the recordings were leaked to the producer of the documentary, Alex Gibney. They also feature police interviews with Sarah Netanyahu and his son, along with interviews with friends of the Prime Minister, his associates and household staff. Mr. Netanyahu has described the legal proceedings against him as a witch hunt, but this week an Israeli court rejected a request from the Israeli Prime Minister to block the documentary being shown at the Toronto Film Festival. Alexis Bloom is the director of the film, and she described what these interrogations show.
Well, the scenes show Benjamin and Sarah and Yair Netanyahu and some of their inner circle in a very candid light. I think we're all used to seeing Netanyahu sort of with his public face forward, kind of giving a news broadcast, but these are profoundly human studies, very intimate, where he has to, and his family have to, answer police interrogators in their own language over a sustained period of time. And that's what makes them fascinating.
But for the most part, Benjamin Netanyahu does remain very calm, does he not, in those interrogations?
He does indeed. And they interrogated him multiple times for many hours. And he does remain calm for the most part. Occasionally, he loses his temper, but he's a great performer. He does know that he's being videoed. The camera is right there.
Mr. Netanyahu calls the charges against him lies, but he has also insisted they were merely tokens of friendship and they didn't act inappropriately in exchange for them. And of course, at the moment, these are just charges.
Yes, they are. He has not been convicted, and that's important to remember. But it's also interesting that the attorney general who indicted him was in fact appointed by Netanyahu. And many people thought Netanyahu wouldn't be indicted.
Calm is not the word you would use for the way in which Benjamin Netanyahu's wife, Sarah, and his son reacted to their interrogations.
No, they're not calm at all. They're irate. I think that they believe they're entitled to do what they want, really, as the first family. And they're massively indignant that they're being asked questions. They're pretty disrespectful, actually, would be the word I would use. You know, they swear at the police and they get very angry.
Of course, these interrogations are part of a more general profile that you portray of Benjamin Netanyahu. And he did have a good start, did he not, to his political career?
Yeah, he had a very strong start. He was 47 when he was first elected, and he had widespread support. And he was, you know, very popular amongst a broad swath of the Israeli public, which is in stark contrast to now.
Also, what comes out very strongly in the documentary is how reliant Benjamin Netanyahu is on his wife, Sarah, to the extent where some argue that he is, in fact, frightened of her.
That's quite a popular and sort of conventional belief in Israel. If you talk to Israelis, lots of people recognize that. It's just not something that's really translated in the West. She's been the most, I would have to say, sort of aggressive first lady. She's on every plane. She's in every meeting. She's by his side a lot. She's certainly the most visible first lady that the country has had. And people who work with him will all acknowledge that she's a key part of his decision making.
And in the documentary, you say and show that she is very critical of those families who've had hostages released for not being more openly thankful to her husband.
I wouldn't say she's very critical. She has been critical of the hostage families. And I think that's enough. You don't really need to be very critical, that you would even be critical a little bit or at all of a family that was going through such profound pain, to me, is surprising. You know, in Israel, there's, you know, a lot of people say Joe Biden has been amazing, meeting people, having his photograph taken with them, being very concerned about the hostage families, you know, and their loved ones. And they sort of contrast that with the Netanyahus.
How, in your view, does the Benjamin Netanyahu in the interrogation room link with his conduct of the war in Gaza at the moment?
Well, the interrogations took place way before the war, so it's hard to link them directly, but it's the same man. And I think that he feels very acutely the weight of the trial that he's currently, you know, participating in. I mean, he's due to be in court in December. So I think the person that he is in the interrogation room is still very much the person that he is today.
And in the documentary, you subscribe to the theory that for as long as this war continues, he hopes he will not have that day in court.
Well, his lawyers are continually applying for postponement. So that's just a fact.
Alexis Bloom, the director of the BB Files, and a quick update on our top story, that meeting between President Biden and Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, where they were expected to discuss allowing Ukraine to use long-range weapons inside Russia. Speaking earlier at a news conference, the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said she wouldn't expect any announcement on this issue.
There's been no policy change, but what I can continue to make sure that you all know and you see it for yourself is that the president is committed to make sure that Ukraine has what it needs to defend itself against Russia's aggression, to defend and fight for their democracy.
That brings to an end this edition of NewsHour.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where is the value?
From the AI revolution...
This is the most amazing time ever, and developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. But we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.